Are you ready to risk your life and play Mission Improbable?
What?
Good. Now listen, little Donnie. Here's the neato tape to give you the question.
Huh?
What is the name of a theatrical group that's heard every Sunday night on Radio Free Oz from 9 to midnight at the Magic Mushroom?
The Berliner Ensemble? The Karl Marx Brothers? The Flying Gotchas?
Too bad, Donnie. That's wrong. It's the Fire Sign Theater.
What?
But hang on, you little twerp. We've got a consolation prize for you.
This tape will now self-destroy you.
What?
So long.
Good morning, and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's special Ides of March episode, we bring you part two of our interview with David Osman and Philip Proctor of the legendary comedy group The Firesign Theater and Firesign archivist Taylor Jessen. We're celebrating both the assassination of Julius Caesar in 44 BC and David, Phil, and Taylor's latest release, The Firesign Theater, Live at the Magic Mushroom. The new release includes a DVD and booklet collecting all 12 plays from the Firesign Theater's performances at the Magic Mushroom in Los Angeles from October 1967 through January 1968. In part one, we talked about how Taylor located the long-lost Magic Mushroom recordings, how the first love-in in Los Angeles led to the birth of the Firesign Theater, why the Magic Mushroom shows were for the Firesigns, what the Hamburg shows were for the early Beatles, the instant chemistry and magic of the group despite its four very disparate members, and the Radio Free Oz Film Festival, perhaps the very first film festival and maybe the last to take place entirely on the radio. And there's a whole lot more in part two, so please sit back, relax, and lend us your ears while we continue our conversation with David, Phil, and Taylor, which is already in progress.
So what's interesting, looking back at the Mushroom release, is how these, you're talking about, a shadow moves upon the lamp, which is like in the middle. It was a pause. And Phil had this script, okay? I'm pretty sure that's how. We had done 20 years Behind the Whale, which is absolutely insane.
The Moby Dick, yeah.
Totally right. Stoned. It breaks off into song in the middle. It is completely the most stoned thing you ever did. Then the shadow moves above the land, then by the light of the silvery, which is the Sherlock Holmes parody that we then took on stage, did many, many times on stage, and finally made the
giant rat of Sumatra
into the giant rat of Sumatra. And having hit that, then the next one was Freak for a Week, which was right current headline stuff. And by headlines, I mean the LA Free Press, headline stuff. And in the Armenian's paw, we began to go into this kind of movie thing. Suddenly these characters began to, we began to find those goon characters. I guess those goon show characters that we could then play with forever. And that went on with Pilot Like It Is and Sesame Mucho. And by the third one of those, I think Austin had it. And he said, here's another idea. And so we did A Life in the Day as the last in the series, which grew into not Dwarf, not Don't Crush That Dwarf, but into the background. Don't Crush That Dwarf. So the television that's on is the television you actually hear in that early January 1968 radio program with, KWKW-TV. Oh, it's another broadcast today. We've always loved broadcasters. I have to say this, thinking about Give Me Immortality or Give Me Death, which is one of the Rhino trilogy. Those were beloved broadcasters, people we felt that we had in some cases stimulated into the business, other people that were just types, wonderful LA radio types. We've always respected our own careers, I guess is what I mean to say. What we do, it's something we really love. It's a very unique skill that allows you to be on the air. Now everybody can do their own podcast inside their balloon from their house. You get on a stage and you've just written this stuff and you read it through once. You go on there, 200 people, and you're getting paid. I think we got, did we get paid? Maybe you got $25. That really wasn't important.
We got health drinks.
Now, when you did the Magic Mushroom shows in the booklet, it says that you committed as a group to writing 1 half-hour play every week and then performing it at the Magic Mushroom during the Radio Free Oz show. Right. What was that like going from the improv, the ad-libbing, the short bits that you did on Radio Free Oz to doing these full-length plays?
Well, you can see how the sketches, the first things are really sketches. And Firesign was never really happy with the sketch format. If anything, we would take a sketch and put it next to another sketch and another sketch, and suddenly you'd have a show made up of pieces, yes, but not. So Exorcism and the Seance are like, they're like sketches. So what did we come back with? Last Tunnel to Fresno. Now, why we did that, I don't know. I have no idea, except maybe to show off accents. Because everybody in the prison camp has a different accent.
And that was a takeoff on Hogan's Heroes at the time.
Yeah. It was Great Escape. There are a couple of World War II movies at the time that influenced us. I mean, we were basically cultural clowns. You know, in the Hopi jargon, we were the mudheads.
The mudheads,
right? who are the clowns that would make fun of their tribal leaders and actually relieve any tensions that might exist in the tribe regarding what was going on. And we all felt that way about the culture. I mean, we had this awful war going on, and commercialism was, you know, becoming more and more evident and having more and more of a deteriorative effect on our culture. And we were being suppressed. The new ideas, the young youth movement was being actively suppressed by the gray-haired old men like me right now. and we were sensitive to that. And I think that that's what underlie was the foundation of all of the comic work that we did. As David expressed articulately very earlier in this interview, we're committed to telling the story of our culture and where it came from. That's why the Indians were so important. Yeah. The real America is what we were often trying to expose. And we'd use popular formats. Look, it's always been my supposition that the reason we finally broke through to the American audience and the international audience, for that matter, was our Nick Danger piece on how can you be in two places at once and you're not anywhere at all. Because it was a parody of a format, the noir detective stories, that people could relate to. And little did they know that we were going to tear it apart, reconstruct it, make it absolutely an insane piece, and
what
take
we were
you
going
along.
To- What we were going to do was we were going to stop the war.
That's right.
That's what it came down. We were stopping the war. It was reading the anti-war subtext to everything we were doing. That was not a war in Korea on Worf. That's a war in Vietnam on Worf. 1970. We were in the studio writing when Kent State was happening.
I mean, we're bringing the war back home. That was our comment on television, which was, you know, now suddenly reaching out. You could actually see the war. You could see the effects of the war, and it changed the consciousness of our culture, of the world. Really, the fact that television suddenly allowed people to be in all these places. It's also my supposition, having spent some time in the Soviet Union with the Yale Russian Chorus in 1959, that it was the satellites up in the air that allowed television to come down to all of these oppressed, suppressed countries so that they could actually see what was happening in the rest of the world. So it's my supposition that the satellites freed the satellites, right? In other words, the countries occupied and owned by the Soviet Union. Poland, of course, was the first place where that revolution occurred. And Lech Walesa was the union leader who guided the movement to free them from Soviet oppression. And what was his profession? Does anybody know?
I do.
What was he?
He was an electrician.
waiting for the electrician or someone like him.
Someone like him, like Walesa.
Like Walesa. So, yeah. And it's true, too, as David will attest to, that many of our albums were very, very predictive of the direction that things were going and things that were going to happen. And I think that's because a comedian exaggerates things. And when we would see certain trends or certain events that were happening, we saw them as we made them into funny events to kind of take the horror out of them, to make people laugh at them, not take it so seriously. And they felt liberated at that point. They didn't feel helpless. They felt as though, well, you know, I can even laugh this away. And we did that with commercials, too, because commercials which are designed to make you feel inferior or needful. And we would do a little bit of brainwashing. We would undo the brainwashing of the effect of this on people by making fun of these things. And that liberated the audience to not take things so seriously. And they could think more clearly and become more activist in their lives. At least that's how I saw it.
I think it worked, actually. What I get from that generation of our fans is that it did open their eyes. It changed their life. A lot of people say that. And at the time, I remember us saying, wait until they hear this. They, yeah. Mean the fans, the people who would hear this. Wait till they hear this. It's so right on. It's so what they have to hear. I think probably the Fireside Theater and The Simpsons have covered the history of the United States in the last 50 years. I think between the two, and maybe those awful little cartoon boys, you know, whoever they are, you know what the ones I mean, the ones that are cut paper.
Faces. South Park?
South Park.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Maybe between the three of us, the three of those, of these expressions, because we've covered every single election. Election years are terrible on people.
Yeah.
We covered 72. Not insane. We gave people the not insane slogan, Pepoon for president. 74, that was the next one. No, that was the midterm election. 76, I ran for vice president. I mean, we were always in that mix, a historical mix. The broadcasting, you listen to this band of what we're talking about in 1970-71, it's historical material. It's really history as it's being written. As we speak, it's being written.
That's right. One of the reasons why the Beatles inspired us was because their songs seemed to be about the culture, drawing from the culture that was happening at the moment. And they weren't afraid to do a long form exposure of that. But when talking about politics, the thing that always has stayed with me was that the night that Bobby Kennedy won the primary and did his speech at the Ambassador Hotel, I think it was, and was assassinated, we had just done a performance of Profiles in Barbecue Sauce,
yep.
Right? Which was a political parody that we performed at the Ash Grove, in which LBJ, during the course of this thing, LBJ got up and spoke about Vietnam without ever saying Vietnam. And at one point, I, portraying a Kennedy, stood up in the audience where I was sitting, said, Mr. President, what about the war in Vietnam? And he said, I told you not to mention that. He pulls out a six shooter and he kills me. And I fall back into all this confetti and balloons that we had as part of the decoration for the show. I am immediately, there's an organ fanfare introduction. David Osman comes out dressed as a Supreme Court judge. Who was that judge? The guy who did. Anyway, and we did a comic quiz show called Who Done It.
I think it was Who Done Did It.
Who Done Did It? Right, and it turns out that John Kennedy was responsible for his own death because he was at the right place at the wrong time, and he had the murder bullet in his head, which is proof that he'd done it. So anyway, we did this crazy thing. And, you know, drank a little champagne and went home. And I turned on the television just in time to see Bobby Kennedy making his victory speech. And a balloon floated up in front of his face. And the camera angle didn't change as he was saying, on to Chicago, and we'll win there. And the balloon floated away. And here's what I thought. When I heard John Kennedy's assassination, I was sitting in Greenwich Village in a coffee shop, and the radio was on, and the Muzak in the radio was interrupted by a bulletin, and it said, someone has thrown firecrackers at the presidential limousine in Dallas. According to one policeman, he is dead. Words to that effect. And I went, wait a minute. Nobody else heard it. You know, which is the curse of being an actor. You see and hear everything because you want to use it. And I said, hey, listen to the radio. All right. That's what I thought of, because the idea of throwing firecrackers, so many people, when they hear gunshots, thinks they're firecrackers. Mm-hmm. I thought of an exploding balloon. And what happened next? He was killed. He was killed.
And, yeah, we had to drop that sketch out of our show.
No kidding.
Yes.
We killed it.
We killed that sketch. You know, the same thing happened to us in Virginia. We're playing Virginia, and Ronald Reagan gets shot. Yes. And we have to drop all the Reagan material out of the show.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know if he was going to make it through or not. You know.
No, but it was right as we were showing up at the theater. They were carting him away. Right. No, they had no idea. But whether he would make it.
I remember I was in a car and Peter was in the car in front of me, and he opened his car door, ran back, tapped on my window, and rolled it down. He said, they've shot Reagan. And yes, that's how, but we were there.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were there. Historically speaking, now that, and everything we've done is politically incorrect.
Yes.
Everything that we've done is certainly not anything you could teach in school, because we're comedians. Yeah. And there's only one comedian that's ever made it to president, and he's not in very good position at the moment. Is that?
Yeah, over in the Ukraine. Right?
Yeah, exactly, in Ukraine.
Nothing to laugh
at. As we record this, that's still going on. But having stood in these places, and in the case of actually running for office, you engage your country in a way that is unique. What we brought to it was a view of our country, which was skewed, honest, weird, truthful.
And satirical.
Satirical.
And satirical, which and is the sword we were wielding, yeah. Right.
And I'm not kidding. I don't know who, what, entertainment unit really has got the late 20th century covered better than the Fireside Theater, historically speaking, with great accuracy, great panache, a lot of fun, a lot of laughs, right up to 2000, 2001, to the, which of course looked forward into the oncoming future, which I believe is oncoming at the moment.
Oh, God, it's almost here. And you know, and we were, that's one of the reasons why we really could not, like the beloved Monty Python, get on television, because what we were saying was too what's the word, dangerous. It was too dangerous. We were making fun of issues that everybody else was taking incredibly seriously, and not really exposing the way satire and comedy can do. And I think that nonetheless, because of our use of audio and the fact that we went on the road and created live shows based on our material, really well produced, thanks to Phil Austin, with great stage effects and lighting and sound and everything. You know, that was, we kept ourselves alive that way. And also FM radio was a great boon for us. As FM, you know, all the time that we worked together, over a 50-year career, you can imagine all of the changes technologically and culturally that were happening in the culture and in the world. And we were there to feed on them and make fun of them. It's not a very good description of what we were doing, but it's at the heart of it, it had to do with creating laughter through recognition in our audience. Like, oh my God, I never looked at it quite that way before. And it allowed them to react and respond to very, very big ideas that were going to affect us all in a way that empowered them, I think.
My first framework for looking at the Magic Mushroom Place was, this is what Firesign did instead of having a 13-episode series on ABC. they made their own show. And I don't think, as much as I would have loved to have seen them as, even with in a country that created laugh in, Firesign Theater could never in the 60s have had a TV show. They would have gone on and immediately torn down every aspect of the network they could. These are guys who did not trust any great power. And it's like Bergman told me in an interview once why they would never have gotten a show in the 2000s on Clear Channel, because the first thing they would have done is made fun of Clear Channel and get fired. So getting fired and being underground heroes are what are went hand in hand for the Fire Sign, I think.
Well, Taylor, the booklet makes clear the whole group, and particularly Peter, were very against joining up with the man. I know he had, just about the time you had your first record contract, didn't he have some lucrative offers from local radio and he turned it down? He didn't want to become part of that system.
That's right. There was big radio money that was trying to woo him to become not Joe Pyne or something, not a horrible, you know, talk radio schmuck, but a hip radio personality to be the anchor they could put on a really good show that would bring in a lot of money for the network. He was not that guy. He couldn't do it.
No, he wouldn't have been able to do that at all. He would go off into a dream. You know, the thing about Peter is that truly Peter was always in two places at once. Peter was always of two minds. When he was on, he was on. And when he was not there, he was someplace else. I could only put it that way. Peter was truly in two places at once. When he stood backstage at the Hillside Theater and the Hunga and said, why don't we call the next album? How can you be in two places at once when we're not anywhere at all? I said, Pete, it's too long. That's too long. Nobody, it's too long for a record title. And the other thing that I think is important to say about following up on 50-year career and all of that, is that we really were unquestionably a rock group. We had a rock contract with a rock record label. We had to sell records just exactly like a rock group, which means you boys have to start playing on the road starting now because your record is out now.
Yeah.
And that's how we ended up at the Ash Grove. And fortunately, it was a great place for us to play. But the rock audience, I never felt part of that. I never felt like I was a rock guy. I mean, they were around the theater and we saw them, but I never felt. But you come away 50 years from it and it's, you know, we were absolutely a rock act.
What the booklet makes clear, David, is, and I didn't know, is Radio Free Oz, they featured guests like Mama Cass. David Crosby apparently was there one night when Peter had too many brownies and collapsed. And then Mickey Dolenz. Oh, you, oh, Phil, so you took over. You took over with David Crosby.
Yep. That's and, right. And we said the wizard had gotten into his balloon and floated up into the air.
Here's about all that happened. All that stuff is all of those programs, all that rock and roll.
Yeah. Dave's absolutely
right. In the archive, it's all can come out. There's so much that can come out.
The booklet makes clear that, Phil, I think you were housemates with Jeremy of Chad and Jeremy.
Yeah, he's still a good friend of ours.
Oh, man, they had a big hit with Yesterday's Gone preceding the Magic Mushroom shows. That house was where you guys were all writing, and you described it as this mansion in Encino with waterfall.
Ape cage. Tiki bar in a bamboo forest. Right? It was a flaming waterfall, by the way. David remembers it too. This huge, huge Spanish style house. We were renting it from Dr. Adolf, who is a radiologist.
What a name.
Dr. Adolf.
Yes.
And it also had a bomb shelter.
Okay? Oh, that's where you stored the pot.
So we put our pot there.
Oh, yeah, it wasn't legal then.
No, it wasn't legal then, no. But bomb shelters were. that tells you something about the society at the time.
Right.
And a huge Olympic-sized swimming pool where in those days we had a lot of naked swimming parties, you know. Just everything was – free love was real. I mean, and it was more than just free sex. There was a sense of community that was so healing and so much fun. And there was a sense of liberty, real liberty. You know, today I posted something on my Facebook page which said, give me liberty or give me death. I'm sorry, we're all out of liberty. That's how I see the world today. That's how I see it. Authoritarianism is such an enormous threat. And people, as Camus wrote in L'Étranger, people really want a strong leader because they don't have to worry about it anymore. Oh, you know, the great leader will take care of us. We're fine. We got our daddy. In Russian, the word government, which is государство, comes from государ, which is like the owner of a plantation. The concept of government to the Russians is the Mother Russia will take care of us. You know, we'll have jobs and we'll have, you know, peace and we'll have culture and music. It's fine. Leave it alone. It'll be fine. And I think that that's part of the danger of what's, you know, kind of destroying the governance in the world and creating a lot of instability, which is not very funny.
But true.
add one thing, because the issue of pot came up. We were the pot comedians.
Yes.
And I'm recalling at that mushroom show, the one that is, what's it called?
Sword in the Stone?
The Sword in the Stone. That's the one. The Sword in the Stone. We did that at the Renaissance Pleasure Fair.
Right.
On the main stage at the Renaissance Fair. But we also did it on stage many, many times during those first, you know, runs at the Ash Grove. And, you know, the movement, no one on the radio can see this, but to place your thumb and forefinger together, bring them slowly to your lips and make
and then pass it on to the next person. Right.
On stage. Then you passed it. I walked down to the front of the stage in this club and passed the invisible joint to the first person who would take it. And some people, there would be the girlfriend who would like, oh. And the guy who's like, I don't know, should I do this? And then the next guy, the hippie guy, whoa, yeah, I got it, man. Our hippie kid. You know, it was, talk about relieving that there was nothing more dangerous. In Los Angeles wasn't any better than Alabama, man. Yeah. I mean, it would bust you.
And Cheech and Chong carried it to the next level.
Yeah.
You know, they were brothers in that regard. And again, all this stuff was liberating.
Yes, that's what I'm. That's what I'm saying.
Exactly. It was part of a community.
You're smoking pot in your bedroom. Yes. It's okay. It's okay because I'm smoking pot in my bedroom. But really? Anybody else here? Yeah, because that joint is going down the aisle. And everybody who takes a fake hit on this fake joint is in the club. And it was very important to think that there was somebody else who agreed. If you're 14, 15, 16, 17 years old, you know, the world is changing under your feet really rapidly in 1967, 8, 9, those years. Ooh, and you can get drafted. You know, on top of that. So I just wanted to say that, you know, now that pot is legal, well, I guess it's not everywhere, but it certainly is here.
And in Oregon, and California.
Listen, it was actually legal back in 1940, because if you listen to the Nick Danger show, one of their sponsors was Fantastic Cigarettes.
That's
Long
right.
in the leaf and short in the can.
They're still laughing at that, man. We wrote that in 1968.
Yeah. And it was predicted. We were predicted. It took a long time for that one to come through.
Yeah, talk about predictive. Just to, you know, wrap my own feeling up about the magic mushroom is it's been a long time coming. There was something about it that we always loved. It was the beginning, and so many of these pieces were worked out on stage and then on albums and transformed really from these very, very quick. I mean, we're in there for 4 days. We're writing for 4 or 5 days. Then we have to go on stage. We have to rehearse. The usual thing. I mean, it was theater. You're under pressure all the time. And you want to be so much funnier next week than you were last week. Yeah. So it really pushed us to write pieces that we could then relax on a little bit. I must say, the next piece we wrote after these pieces was Nick Danger. As a pilot for the next radio series, which we never did, at the Elks Building in L.A. at, is it Elysian Park? No,
MacArthur Park,
where the pie and the cake,
where the cake melted.
And when Nick bumps into the great sandstone building, that's the Elks Club on the other side, and. Because we were going to do that show there. So it's true that the next thing after these 12 shows was Nick Danger for the next radio show, which we didn't get. And so we put it on the record.
That's right. Yeah. In a sense, what David is saying is very true. We were writing a serial. Even the Magic Mushroom shows represent, you know, the creation of a new show every week that was going to make you laugh, with a new theme that would usually allow us to parody some aspect of the society that was scaring people. and the fact that these goons were up there making rapid fire fun of it did free them. It freed us, and you know, and it must have freed them too. So that's what we call freedom.
And that last play, A Life in the Day, of the Magic Mushroom plays, which was not performed at the Magic Mushroom, but apparently in the lobby of the KRLA headquarters in Los Angeles, that led to Dwarf, again, with the TV-type channel switching format.
Yeah. So it led to the brilliant thing is the channel switch. Mm-hmm. The channel switch was the cleverest thing we ever thought of. It means you don't have to ever finish an idea.
Yeah, but that's right.
It, you're bored. You can go away. Think, click.
But just again, like we were predicting TV. We were predicting channel surfing.
Yeah,
right.
Because we knew it was happening, even if you had to lean forward and move a dial.
One last question for Taylor, because this was something you wrote in the booklet, and it's about Peter. You said Peter Bergman's biography could and will fill an entire book. So as a big fan of the whole group, and Peter, of course, is there something in the works, a Bergman bio?
Oh, that was more factual than prognosticated, I'm afraid. His biography should and does and will. It's required. A book is required. Probably several books are required just to describe. To have the actual book is going to be a lot of work, but there is such an amazing story there, most of which he told in a series of interviews to his then wife, Mary Edith Burrell. And it's exactly as nuts as you would imagine. Him going to Yale and then hanging out at Yale and teaching labor economics, and then getting on his first European trip, where he's I believe he ends up in Finland and is told to turn the other way because there's a Russian nuclear test happening the other direction. That was his first experience with a real big lie. And then he goes to the Middle East and deals hash and tries to smuggle it back in through Turkey, sealed in cans. And then he starts, he was in Europe. He made his own detective film called Flowers. He goes to LA. He meets up with the Fireside Theater, and then things get crazy. So yes, there is a lot of really good, nutty material that deserves its own book.
In the easy way of saying, gee, they're all four really different guys. They really are four really different guys. Peter came with this incredible, a load of experiences. He was just birthing with the last two or three years of experience and being, we could go on and on. And Proctor, who was in the throes of the beginning burst of a career and television and yes, and then a movie, and we got that, and I got always been a play, and I'm on the radio, and I'm in this happy world of being on the radio. My past is all poets and surrealism. So bringing the backstories, as Phil has narrated in his biography, the backstories to where we started, we were pretty well loaded up before, before we had that fateful meeting. We were ready to meet the people who could help us individually and be what we wanted to be, to break through that thing, to find a place. Very hard. This is not an easy world. Hollywood is not an easy place. Show business is a very difficult career. And we were all right at the beginning of it between the ages of 25 and 30.
They found their instrument. They went to radio. They did the Radio Free Oz Film Festival. And suddenly, these four guys who were all waiting to jam suddenly found their instrument. It's the radio. And it's in their hands. And nobody could take it away from them.
And that's why you were called the Beatles of comedy. I just had one last question for you, Taylor. And that's, where can listeners find out more about the Live at the Magic Mushroom release? And there's also a book out that collects the scripts that came out earlier from Bear Manor Media, Exorcism in Your Daily Life, the psychedelic Firesign Theater at the Magic Mushroom in 1967.
Indeed. All you have to do is go to firesigntheater.com. You will find links to where you can buy all this product. Some of it from us, including the Magic Mushroom book, and the books of scripts, including Profiles in Barbecue Sauce and Exorcism in Your Daily Life, as well as all of the rest of the great Firesign script output and two novels by David from Bear Manor. You'll find a link to Bear Manor Media at firesigntheater.com as well.
And Phil and David have not slowed down. They're still acting, also, they're producing, they're writing.
True. I'm playing a, David was talking about silver-haired commentators. I'm playing one on a new podcast called Curveballs, and it's just a perfect opportunity for me to embrace my age. But also the things you can get on the Fireside Theater site are Procter & Bergman things. Because Peter, I did tour with Peter for years, which is another whole story, believe me. And I wrote about that in a couple of books, which are at Bear Manor. Plus there's our script Power, which was produced by Ted Bonnet, who's still a dear friend.
Oh, you do and a podcast with him, don't you?
I do, yeah. Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show. We actually I appeared, as I said, pitching on KPFK a couple of days ago now. And we actually are looking for a home there, okay, so that we could record our show from there. We've done about 28 interviews with people like Penn Jillette and Weird Al and Tom Hartman and, oh my God, so many fascinating people. So if you go to sexyboomershow.com, you can listen to some of them. And yes, it does continue. And David and I worked together for a while performing until, of course, COVID stopped everything. And we are still collaborating whenever we can, you know, especially on these wonderful visual radio podcasts. It's so much fun to work together.
And the three of us, Taylor, Phil, and I, are bringing the Fireside Theater out. If we got bored with it, you know, I mean, that'd be easy. Oh, gee, I've heard all those Joni Mitchell songs again. That's gonna, it's your Bob Dylan, you know? I mean, Bob, he was good with the Beatles. I can't listen to him. I think we're still in play, and we're very lucky. I am 85 years old, which is older than anybody. Show business, guys, go, you know? I remember we were at the Friars Club, Phil. You remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
And every comedian who was still alive in L.A. was there. And they were all Jewish comedians, of course. They were all smoking cigars.
Yep.
And I thought, oh, boy, you know, did you ever get to be that old? His red buttons, he's 160. You know,
he was gray buttons.
But we're there now. We're still having a wonderful time, still working, and still the material is still coming out, and people are still laughing. What more can we give?
Yeah, it's a blessing. It really is.
Well, I was absolutely delighted by the Live at the Magic Mushroom DVD. The booklet, as a longtime fan, I still learned a whole lot. We didn't get a chance to tell the Abe Lasfogel story, but readers could look that up in the booklet, which is a good one. And it's always a great privilege for me to talk with you. I again, a very longtime fan from the Dear Friends, the Let's Eat show in L.A. On KPFK in the early 70s. So I didn't quite catch it the Magic Mushroom days, but a few years later, I just want to thank you all, David, Phil, and Taylor.
Thank you. And I do want to say that if you want to keep up with some of our shenanigans, you can go to planetproctor.com. Where I try to keep anything that's happening with Fireside Theater to include it in the blog that I send out, and there's always something happening with us.
There is.
Yes,
it's delightful and wonderful at our age.
I don't want to promote Facebook, but I do have a site there, and it always says what's going on if something is going on. You know,
David's doing a great job of promoting everything that we're doing. So please. Go to his humorous site.
And follow us on Twitter. We have secured finally at last the handle at Firesign Theater. So we are on Twitter.
The twits are on Twitter. Yay!
Yeah.
And of course, we can't thank Taylor enough for his tremendously talented ongoing support of Firesign Theater and figuring out primarily with David. Ways to release our material in a fun way for everybody to not only keep us alive, but I think to renovate, to rejuvenate.
Yeah,
I call us the Frankenstein Theater because I don't think we'll ever die as long as we keep getting parts together. Right.
All right. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, KBOO and Portland, who've been so wonderful. To the Fireside Theater. Our last performances were in Portland.
Right, and the last live performance as a group. In fact, your last radio appearance as a group was also at KBOO. Yeah.
Live at KBOO. That was scary. KBOO!
Right.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had a director, you can listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today,
David Osman and Philip Proctor of the legendary comedy group The Firesign Theater, and Firesign archivist Taylor Jessen. You can find out more about their latest release, The Firesign Theater Live at the Magic Mushroom, and all Firesign news and projects on their website, firesigntheater.com. Just a reminder that KBOO is in the home stretch of our winter drive, which we like to call All Thrills, No Frills. Or how do I make my voice do that? We're trying to raise $15,000 by March 19th, and we could use your help. KBOO is true listener-sponsored community radio. We get 80% of our funding from our members, listeners like you. You can support programs like this and independent media by becoming a member today. It's as simple as going to the KBOO website, kboo.org, and clicking on the big donate button, or you can text KBOO to 44321. Together, we can keep KBOO going strong throughout 2022, which marks our 54th year on the airwaves, and hopefully many more years to come. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, March 24th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
you may wait here in the sitting room, or you can sit here in the waiting room.